Willow Weep for Me by the very first Mike Garrett Quartet. My thanks to Daryl Scheinman at the Gearbox label for his help in finding a copy of this vinyl-only release, which finally came out last year, 53 years after it was recorded. As well as Mike on piano, it featured Pete Shade vibes, Paul Hemmings bass and Brian Barnes drums. Remember the Radio 3 piano season coming up next month, and do send me your requests to jazz.record.requests@bbc.co.uk or by post to Broadcasting House, London W1A 1AA. But until next week, from me, Alan Shipton, goodbye.
Jazz Record Requests was presented by Alan Shipton. BBC Radio 3. Well, now it's time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Petrop Trelawney.
A trio of great 19th century works at the proms this evening from the London Philharmonic Orchestra and Vladimir Yurovsky.
The proms have given our programme a title, The Romantics, and I think there is a general misconception about what is romanticism, audience often assuming that romanticism is something close to romance, romantic feelings, etc. In fact, romanticism for me is a radical state of being at odds with the world. People who relate to the world in this sequence, me and the world around me, rather than the world and my place in it.
Well, at odds with the world tonight, Byron's tortured Manfred, subject of Tchaikovsky's hour-long programmatic symphony, which we'll hear in the second half of the concert. And perhaps Gustav Mahler himself, writing a highly personal text for the song cycle Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen. The narrator, bruised by his failure in love, the work sung tonight by the mezzo-soprano Alice Coote. And to begin, the overture to the work that kick-started German romantic opera, Weber's Der Freischütz, The Free Shooter. Here, the one looking for his place in the world is Max, who's lost his powers of marksmanship, but still hopes to win his sweetheart in the shooting contest by using magic bullets cast by his treacherous friend Kaspar. Well, the overture is in two principal keys, C major and C minor, representing the healthy aspects of life versus evil and sinister powers. Horns conjure up visions of forests and hunting. Low clarinets and timpani represent the dark side of the drama. Der Freischütz opened at the Schauspielhaus in Berlin in 1821. At the end of that decade, it had been produced across Europe. So Vladimir Yurovsky conducts the London Philharmonic Orchestra here at the Proms in the overture to Weber's Der Freischütz. Vladimir Yurovsky conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra, the overture to Weber's opera Der Freischütz, starting this Saturday evening prom in once again a packed Royal Albert Hall. The overture central to the prom since the very first season in 1895. Yet it was only last year that the complete opera was heard, and that was in French, so we still await the original German premiere. 1821, when it opened in Berlin, by the end of that decade it had been produced in English, Russian, Swedish, Czech, Polish and Dutch, and before 1850, indicative of its popularity, it had been staged as far away as Cape Town, Sydney and Rio. Well, one of Weber's greatest fans was Gustav Mahler. In the late 1880s, he completed an opera Weber had left unfinished, Die Drei Pintos, managing to crack Weber's complicated musical code, while at the same time having an affair with the wife of Weber's grandson. A few years earlier, in 1883, Mahler had become music director of the opera house, the German city of Kassel. One of the first works that he conducted there was Der Freischütz, amongst his favourite operas. And it was at Kassel that Mahler fell for a company soprano, Johanna Richter. His love was not reciprocated, but the unhappy experience prompted a song cycle, Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen. Here at the Royal Albert Hall, the songs are about to be performed by Alice Coote, who's a featured artist at this year's proms. They're heavily folk-influenced in their style. Mahler wrote the text himself. In the first, he describes the pain of his beloved's wedding to someone else. I'll go into my little room to weep for my love. Then he takes a walk through the countryside. Dew, birds, sunshine, flowers, everything is beautiful, except there's something missing, his beloved. I have a glowing knife in my heart, starts the next song. Oh, woe, it cuts so deep into every joy, every pleasure. Final song begins in the manner of a funeral march. He's been driven forth by a vision of his beloved's eyes. But then finally he finds peace under the blossom of a linden tree, except that that signifies death, thoughts of which are all that provide any consolation. The score of this last song is marked without sentimentality. There's no room for self-pity. And in the music, beautiful and tuneful though it is, there's also what the critic Michael Kennedy describes as a sharp edge verging on bitter irony. Peter Schumann, leader of the London Philharmonic Orchestra this evening, tuning the orchestra. Songs of a Wayfaring Lad, how the title of this song cycle translates. The journeyman, wayfarer of the title, one of the main symbolic figures of German Romanticism. The outsider, rejected by those he loves, who embarks on a journey to find affection and somehow sate spiritual hunger. Goethe's Werther, a good example in literature. In music, I suppose Schumann's Winterreiser or Brahms' Alto Rhapsody. One of the striking figures of this piece is that not one of the songs ends in the same key that it began in. Mahler's intention, perhaps to symbolise the notion of a progressive journey. Musically, it anticipates a procedure that he was to adopt in his later symphonies. Well, Alice Coote appeared right back at the beginning of the prom season this year, giving the first Cadogan Hall chamber music prom of the season, a wonderful programme of French song. And a week yesterday, she was here with the Halle singing in Elgar's Apostles. And she's wearing a brilliant blue dress tonight. Electric blue, I think. Comes out with Vladimir Yurovsky, who's just managed to drop his baton, but quickly picked it up again. She joins the London Philharmonic Orchestra, Alice Coote the soloist, and Mahler's Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen.
Oh! Thank you.
Alice Coote singing Mahler's Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen. A kiss from Vladimir Yurovsky, principal conductor of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, as Coote moves to the front of the stage, bows to the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall, and the orchestra now stand behind her. Upon the road, there stands a linden tree, where for the first time I slept at peace. Under the linden tree, which snowed its blossom upon me, I knew no more of life's travail. All was well again, all. Love and sorrow, the world and dreams. Text by Mahler himself, written after the rejection he'd encountered. He fell in love with a singer at the opera house in Kassel in Germany. Alice Coote now back on stage alone this time. As I mentioned, featured artist in this 2012 season of the BBC Proms. Truly now an international performer. She'll be singing Leonora in La Favorita at the Champs-Élysées in Paris next season. Sextus in Julius Caesar for the Metropolitan Opera in New York. The Rocket Leader coming up at the Barbican, and Berlioz's Les Nuits d'Été in Chicago under Sir Mark Elder. Is with Mark Elder, a great supporter of Alice Coote, that she performed the Apostles here at the Proms last week. Back on the platform now with Yurovsky. Mahler wrote the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen with piano accompaniment first between 1883 and 1885 while he was working in Kassel. Later, several of its ideas were used in the First Symphony. And then he orchestrated the songs in the early 1890s, a decade after he'd first written them. Even then, though, he kept on tinkering, and the songs didn't reach their final form until 1897, when they were published. Well, the year that Mahler completed the first version of the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, Tchaikovsky wrote his great work Manfred, a symphony in four scenes after a dramatic poem by Byron. We're going to hear the work in 20 minutes' time here on Radio 3, after the interval in which we join Matthew Sweet and his guests for today's Proms Plus Literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello. As you listen, there's an unseemly rush for the bars at the Royal Albert Hall. It's all elbows and requests for gin. But we're going to spend the interval doing something much more civilised. We're going to get a reading list from one of this country's biggest opera stars. She's Christine Rice, the mezzo-soprano who became cinema's first 3D Carmen, who was the first Ariadne to brave the horns of Harrison Birtwistle's Minotaur, and who played the role of the Israelite man in this year's Proms production of Judas Maccabeus. Not the first time that she's changed gender for the sake of her art. In this programme, she'll be sharing her literary passions and revealing how they reflect her life and her music. And I'm pleased to say that an equally powerful voice, that of the actor Andrew Wincott, will be bringing them into being. Chris, first let's get some sense of the place of literature in your life. In what circumstances would we find you reading a book?
Well, I do lots of travelling. So having a family, I don't read much at home. But when I go away for work and I'm in a hotel by myself, then I have a quiet read.
We should probably reveal at the start of this programme that you and I have known each other since we were 16 years old.
We're going to own up to that, are we?
So I've been looking at Christine's bookshelves for 26 years now. And the first extract that you've chosen is something that connects with your pre-operatic life, I think.
Yes. Well, this was Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. It was a totally fantastic read for me because it was published at a time when I had already physics behind and moved into music. And so it just sort of refreshed all that and got all those neurons firing again. And it's an absolutely superb book from the science point of view.
Okay, Andrew, let's hear something from it.
When the skies are clear and the moon is not too bright, the Reverend Robert Evans, a quiet and cheerful man, lugs a bulky telescope onto the back sun deck of his home in the Blue Mountains of Australia, about 80 kilometers west of Sydney, and does an extraordinary thing. He looks deep into the past and finds dying stars. Looking into the past is, of course, the easy part. Glance at the night sky, and what you see is history, and lots of it. Not the stars as they are now, but as they were when their light left them. For all we know, the North Star, our faithful companion, might actually have burned out last January, or in 1854, or at any time since the 14th century, and news of it just hasn't reached us yet. The best we can say, can ever say, is that it was still burning on this date 680 years ago. Stars die all the time. What Bob Evans does better than anyone else who has ever tried is spot these moments of celestial farewell. By day, Evans is a kindly and now semi-retired minister in the Uniting Church in Australia, who does a bit of locum work and researches the history of 19th century religious movements. By night, he is, in his unassuming way, a titan of the skies. He hunts supernovae.
Thank you. So, Christine, that's an account of the life scientific. Do you miss that life? You were going to be a physicist, weren't you?
Yeah, I missed the science. When I reread this book, it was so dense with fascinating information and the connections that scientists made. What I also thought it was did absolutely brilliantly was show the struggle that the scientist goes through, and particularly between colleagues. There's some very spicy stories of backstabbing and rivalry. Reading that, I understood why for me, science was not the career choice.
It feels quite an unusual switch to make. I mean, do you remember the moment when you realised that you had a voice that was powerful enough to allow you to leave one world and enter another?
No, I think because when I went to music college, I had made no assumptions that it would be a career change. I purely had come to the end of my journey with science and where I was happy to sort of take it, and I was looking for something else. And I decided to give myself a year to think and do something else in that year. So it was very much a kind of sidestep, not a definite sort of career choice. And I was very lucky to meet a fantastic singing teacher when I was at music college, and that changed my life.
And is this sense of wonder that we get of that kind of scientific endeavour, is that something that, I mean, is there a parallel to that in the world of music? Does it press some of the same buttons for you?
Oh, I mean, most definitely. If only you think of what the composers have done, the achievement there. No, you sit on the concert platform, you reach the end of a piece and you know, it's spine-tingling.
Let's move on to your next choice, which is something from a great cycle of novels produced in the Edwardian period.
Yes, I absolutely loved all of the Forsyth saga. There's 9 books in total, and I could have picked any of the 9 books, but I thought if this was a recommendation, then people should start at the beginning. So I chose A Man of Property.
Okay, let's hear something from that, Andrew.
Soames Forsyth could not understand what his wife found wrong with him. It was not as if he drank. Did he run into debt, or gamble, or swear? Was he violent? Were his friends rackety? Did he stay out at night? On the contrary. The profound, subdued aversion which he felt in his wife was a mystery to him, and a source of the most terrible irritation. That she had made a mistake and did not love him, had tried to love him and could not love him, was obviously no reason. He that could imagine so outlandish a cause for his wife's not getting on with him was certainly no Forsyth. Soames was forced, therefore, to set the blame entirely down to his wife. He had never met a woman so capable of inspiring affection. They could not go anywhere without his seeing how all the men were attracted by her. Their looks, manners, voices betrayed it. Her behavior under his attention had been beyond reproach. That she was one of those women, not too common in the Anglo-Saxon race, born to be loved and to love, who when not loving were not living, had certainly never even occurred to him. Her power of attraction he regarded as part of her value, as his property. But it made him indeed suspect that she could give as well as receive, and she gave him nothing. Then why did she marry me? Was his continual thought.
Thank you, Andrew. I find it really easy to imagine the Forsyte saga as some enormous opera cycle. It could be our Ring, couldn't it, if somebody put their name to it?
Yes, yes. Particularly this relationship between Soames and Irene. There's so much rage and frustration on his side and this sort of passivity that she presents. Whereas as you get to know her better, she's very deeply feeling, but of course within the book you don't experience her directly. She's indirectly written about. You only see her through other people's eyes.
Is she like an opera heroine to any extent?
She wouldn't get many of her own arias, would she? she is this sort of, you know, often cast as sopranos, I shall say, without rather huffily, the soprano character is always this untouchable beauty, a woman, you know, ripe for loving and often thwarted in love.
So she's certainly a soprano part then, if we...
I think she's a soprano,
okay. What's
yes.
the difference in terms of the sensibility of the singer, do you think, between a mezzo and a soprano?
Well, I think there's a silveriness to the soprano voice. I mean, obviously, you get a range of sopranos and you get the heavier, more dramatic ones. But in terms of a stark difference between soprano and mezzo, then the mezzo voice is a warmer, more yielding sound, often given to older characters, perhaps the more kind of sexually open.
So it's a sexier kind of voice then. Sexier roles go with
well,
this voice.
Well, yes, more permissive.
Well, Carmen would be a fantastic
yes.
example of that,
Carmen.
Wouldn't she?
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen you play her on stage with fantastic gouts of blood spraying everywhere.
Yes, yes, a good death. That's what you want with Carmen.
And on the cinema screen too, in 3D.
In 3D. The very thought.
Tell us about that experience.
Actually, that was remarkable because they had these huge cameras taking up most of the stalls and a track with a camera going along at the front, sometimes between you and the conductor. So it was very, very present, the filming, whereas normally when they film for television, the cameras are at the back and it's discreet and you're just there with the audience. So it was much more noticeable. But even then with that, they melted away. Whilst you concentrate on your job, you're busy telling a story and you cease to notice them. And I thought the end result was fantastic because I do think that when you film an art form like opera or ballet, there is an element that's lost and that helped to regain some of it.
Let's move on to the next extract, which is from work by Sebastian Folkes.
Yes.
Why have you chosen this one?
This is Human Traces and I found it a very beautiful and deeply moving book. Again, actually, it has quite a heavy science content to it. And it is about two scientists and their endeavours in life.
Andrew, let's hear from it.
When Daniel was six, he had been taught in school about St. Valentine and under the mistress's instruction, made a coloured card for his love. He drew on it a picture of flowers in a bunch and inside, again with the teacher's help, wrote... Dear Mummy, be my Valentine. Love? ? He watched intently as Sonia opened it that evening and feigned amazement, delight, then utter bafflement as to the identity of her admirer. Have you any idea who it might be, Daniel? He pursed his lips and shrugged with his palms turned outward at the bottom of his skinny arms, trying not to smile. For weeks, Sonia kept the card on the mantelpiece in her bedroom. It was the question mark that that made her laugh every time she looked at it. When Jacques came back from work, he took to asking her, "How are you, my love? And how is Monsieur Question Mark? How is little Herr Fragezeichen?" As for Sonia, what she felt for the child was beyond words, and she did not really care to examine it. When he had saved with his own money to buy her a present, a useless embroidered purse, the pleasure of receiving it was so shot through with a sort of anguish at what it told of Daniel and of his view of her that the pleasure lasted only for an instant, and she experienced the charming gesture as a sort of memento mori. Likewise, when she went to kiss him goodnight, the last thing before she herself went to bed, she murmured words of utter devotion as she leaned over. As she kissed him and inhaled the smell of him, she felt her whole being shift in her guts and knew that this vertiginous lurch of feeling came about in her because she was really thinking what a short time he would remain a child. The nights could be numbered, and what a short life would be his on earth. In truth, it occurred to her, she was not kissing her child a happy good night. She was thinking of his death.
Thank you.
It's very powerful, isn't it, that? And I can see it stirs something very deep in you.
Yes, I find this book almost overwhelming, and it is the character of Sonia, really. For me, she was the one that leapt off the page, and her experience, particularly of motherhood, being a wife. There's certain moments that I can think of, not least when my first daughter was 6 weeks old and I got on a plane and I went to America, and I remember gripping the seat for the first time in my life thinking I was going to die in an air crash. And I'd been a perfectly confident flyer before then, and it was it's the sort of this sudden intensity of the importance of your life when you become a parent, and the love you experience for your child is something completely other.
When journalists write you up, they like that idea of the sort of the super mum opera star, don't they? This is always part of the story. You know, Ian Bostridge has children. Nobody ever congratulates him for having an opera career as well, do they? How do you feel about that?
Yes, well, I mean, it is the modern conundrum, isn't it, for a woman, whether you choose to pursue a career. Actually, a musical career is tremendously combinable with a family because we don't have the fixed hours. You can do a bit of pick and choose in advance which work you do take. I'm absolutely passionate about both things. I'm incredibly lucky that the two streams of my life are both passions.
And yet I have heard musicians say, I won't name any of them, well, you've got to choose one or the other.
I'm sure that certain people believe that. I don't feel that I've shortchanged either one, but you can never live a different life, so who knows where I would have gone with singing if I hadn't had children. I certainly have no regrets.
Let's move on to your next reading, which I think you may have chosen for small people beyond this room. What's this?
This is David Walliams, and it's Billionaire Boy. Now, I could have chosen any of his books because they're marvellous, and I do lots of reading to my kids at bedtime. And some of the books trip off your tongue easier than others, and these are fantastic. These are so beautiful to read, and they're funny for adults as well as children, and they are shot through with ideas of moral messages.
There's something
messages.
We need to know before we hear Andrew read from this, isn't there?
Yes, you need to know what bum fresh is. Bum fresh is an invention of Mr. Spud, who is Joe's father. He worked in a factory, a toilet roll factory, for many, many years, and eventually came up with the idea of a double-sided toilet roll, one which moisturises your bottom.
Fresh bum, this is called.
Is it fresh bum? Wrong way round, there you go.
Andrew.
When Mr. Spud finally launched Fresh Bum, it was an instant phenomenon. Mr. Spud sold 1 billion rolls around the world every day. And every time a roll was sold, he made 10p. It all added up to an awful lot of money, as this simple maths equation shows. 10p times 1 billion rolls times 365 days a year equals a lot of wonga. Soon, father and son moved out of their pokey council flat and into an enormous stately home. Mr. Spud named it Fresh Bum Towers. The house was so large, it was visible from outer space. It took 5 minutes just to motor up the drive. Hundreds of newly planted, hopeful little trees lined the mile-long gravel track. The house had 7 kitchens, 12 sitting rooms, 47 bedrooms, and 89 bathrooms. Even the bathrooms had ensuite bathrooms. And some of those ensuite bathrooms had en-ensuite bathrooms. "Can I have a proper present as well, Dad?" said Joe as he put the cheque in his trouser pocket. "I mean, I've got loads of money already." "Tell me what you want, son, and I'll get one of my assistants to buy it," said Mr. Spud. "Some solid gold sunglasses? I've got a pair. You can't see out of them, but they're very expensive." Joe yawned. "Your own speedboat," ventured Mr. Spud. Joe rolled his eyes. "I've got 2 of those, remember?" "Sorry, son. How about £250,000 worth of W.H. Smith vouchers?" "Boring, boring, boring!" Joe stamped his feet in frustration. Here was a boy with high-class problems. Joe suddenly had a thought. He pictured himself going round the racetrack all on his own, racing against himself. "Well, there is something I really want," he said tentatively.
"Name it, son," said Mr. Spud.
"A friend."
Thank you. In a way, it's quite a traditional story, isn't it? Because it has this kind of the moral imperative of those early children's stories.
They are. Yeah, no, absolutely. They're incredibly well done, though. They're sort of not... Because you get a lot of propaganda within the education system when your kids bring home, you know, 5 a day fruit and veg homework and, you know, go running, be active homework, and everything sort of has a message from school. So you come to a book like this, and the fact that the message that he's making is so skillfully handled and so entertainingly portrayed that it's a pleasure as an adult to follow it, but certainly the kids just swept away by it.
How does the fact that you're a performer affect the way that you read to your children? I mean, do you give it everything?
I suppose you'd have to ask them. I occasionally become a little bit self-conscious and think, did I deliver that well enough? But no, I mean, it's great because I love doing it. I love doing it. So, and I think they feel that. They know it.
None of the herons that you played ever start kind of leeching into your private life, do you? Do they? The operatic mode never takes over, does it?
No, I'm very good at doing a role and leaving it behind. Yeah, very good.
Okay. Well, that's where we have to close the book now, unfortunately. My thanks to Andrew Wincott for reading for us today and to Christine Rice. Thank you for sharing your literary passions.
Thank you.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Luke Mulhall. And this is Petroc Trelawney welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall, where this Saturday night prom features the London Philharmonic Orchestra under principal conductor Vladimir Yurovsky. To finish, the orchestra play a late 19th century masterwork, Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony, written in 1885, inspired by Byron's dramatic poem telling of a tormented man deeply anguished by his shaming behaviour in the past, now wandering tortured through the Alps. The critic Vladimir Stasov and the composer Milya Balakirev provided a very detailed synopsis for Tchaikovsky to work from. It's outlined in the programme for tonight's concert, which you can view online right now at bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, when I spoke to Vladimir Yurovsky earlier on, he told me how Manfred was a work the orchestra had become very familiar with.
It's one of those pieces which, unless the orchestra knows it inside out, creates almost insuperable problems technically and musically, because the structure is completely different from any other Tchaikovsky symphony. It's more of a laboratory of a composer, it's a workshop of a composer who is experimenting, alone the amount of extra instruments, organ, 2 harps, bass clarinet, cor anglais, a huge percussion section. That alone makes it for a theatrical piece.
And you've extended the strings.
And I've extended the strings following the Russian tradition of the 20th century. I mean, the impact which the amount of strings, 18 first violins, give to this music is absolutely unique. And we know that Tchaikovsky has always insisted to have as many strings as physically possible.
It's clearly something of a signature piece for you, because you've been doing it with the orchestra for nearly a decade. You recorded it back in 2004. Generally, it's not performed as often as the numbered symphonies. What is it that attracts you about it?
I inherited the love for this piece from two conductors, from my father and from Gennady Rozhdestvensky, who I think was the first conductor to discover the similarities between this Tchaikovsky and Stravinsky, the neoclassical Stravinsky. Tchaikovsky used this piece as a pretext to experiment with different textures and with the different type of symphonism, much more theatrical type of symphonism, which at the same time led into the neoclassical 20th century. And if you listen carefully, there are segments of the symphony which already remind you of the later works of Tchaikovsky, the Sixth Symphony, Nutcracker, the Queen of Spades. All the later masterpieces are already contained, like in a nutshell, in this Manfred.
Vladimir Yurovsky, who now conducts the London Philharmonic Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Manfred. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Vladimir Yurovsky conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Manfred. Manfred's symphony in four scenes after a dramatic poem by Byron. The final chorale, coloured by the religious overtones of the organ spelling Manfred's death. In Byron's drama, the last words spoken by the abbot. He's gone. His soul hath taken its endless flight. Whither? I dread to think. But he is gone. Yurovsky, back on stage. Manfred had its British premiere here at the Proms under Henry Wood in 1898. The critic from the musical Times wasn't impressed, finding it a decidedly pretentious work, 1 hour and 3 minutes in performance, he noted. Didn't return to the Proms, this is amazing actually, until 1962. That first Proms performance back in 1898 shared the stage with a Fantasia after Gilbert and Sullivan's The Yeoman of the Guard, which will be here at the Proms tomorrow night. Percussion section of the London Philharmonic Orchestra on their feet. Timpanist Simon Carrington. Brass, now woodwind, bassoons and bass clarinets. Tim Lyons, principal clarinet. John Ryan, principal horn. Ian Hardwick, principal oboe. And Sue Thomas, principal flute. There is, Vladimir Yurovsky told me earlier, an agonising quality about the beauty of Manfred. And that's why I decided to put it together with Weber and Mahler, both of whom have this morbid quality to their music. Didn't catch the whole of this evening's prom, the Lieder eines fahrenden Gesellen, the overture to Weber's opera, Der Freischütz, in the first part of the programme. Available to listen again via the Radio 3 website. Television cameras in this evening as well. This prom will be broadcast on BBC 4 next Friday at 7:30. Well, the London Philharmonic Orchestra, about to celebrate its 80th birthday season. It starts on the 29th of September with a Russian bell-inspired programme at the Royal Festival Hall. Bells in the Fog by Edison Denisov. Rodion Shehadrin's Concerto for Orchestra, The Chimes, and Rachmaninoff's The Bells. Now though, Yurovsky back on the stage brings the London Philharmonic Orchestra to its feet. We reached the end of this broadcast this Saturday evening from what I think has been the hottest night so far here at the Royal Albert Hall. Not that it's stopped some wonderful music making. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Good night from me, Petroc Trelawney, back to David Cornett at Broadcasting House.
Petroc, and just a reminder that there's that other chance to hear tonight's prom on Wednesday week at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow evening, as Petroc also mentioned earlier on, for a prom's performance of Gilbert and Sullivan's Yeoman of the Guard, starting at 7:30.
Children are naturally curious, and schools too often kill and blunt curiosity, partly because of the obsession with exams.
What should our schools teach?
Dance, drama, music, we find difficult to measure. And because politicians don't ask for them to be measured, lots of schools get the message that they're not valued.
A new series looks at fundamental questions in education.
We've just got to change the language, stop using vocational as if we mean not very bright, and actually make that a really valued part of our national curriculum.
The education debates begin on BBC Radio 4 this Wednesday night at 8.
Coming up next this evening, Free Thinking. That's in just under 8 minutes' time. Thank you. Valse Caprice No. 3 in G flat major by Gabrielle Fauré, played by Catherine Stott. Well, in 45 minutes' time, at 10:30, Sarah Moore Peach will be presenting five new pieces written for the Cultural Olympiad as part of the 2012 festival celebrating some of the UK's most exciting composing talent. The music is by Mark Anthony Turnage, Aaron Cassidy, Julian Joseph, Gavin Higgins, Liz Liu and Andy Leung. And it was recorded across the UK in Edinburgh, Nottinghamshire and London, and it's introduced by each of the composers, with the performers including the vocal ensemble Exaudi, the Rambert Orchestra and prisoners and staff at Her Majesty's Prison, Loudoun Grange. So that's tonight at 10:30. But now here on BBC Radio 3, another chance to hear the psychotherapist Susie Orbach challenging the obsession with personal change in a talk recorded in front of a live audience at the Sage Gateshead as part of the BBC Radio 3 Free Thinking Festival 2011. It's hosted by Philip Dodd.
I wish I was younger. I wish I had more hair, was more patient. I wish. I'm as prone to dreams of change and perfection as anyone else. So it's a great pleasure to have the psychotherapist and author Susie Orbach here to challenge the belief that we can be perfect, to unravel our obsession with change. Now, Susie Orbach initially made her name as the author of Fat is a Feminist Issue, published in 1978. The book argued that body weight is more a state of mind than a physical condition. And she's gone on to write many more books, including a very fine one on emotional literacy. She's been practicing as a therapist for 30 years or so, so she's a fair knowledge in her daily work of all our fears and our dreams. Susie Orbach.
Thank you. Jim's 58. He started to dye his hair. Not discreetly, as did men of yesteryear with pomade, but the full Monty, peroxide and L'Oreal, because you're worth it. He's considering having more hair sewn in. He's already had derma fillers and Botox. His mantra is self-improvement. Updating his body is just part of it. He takes classes in Soroka and Mandarin. A makeover to his flat is on the agenda. Spiritually, he goes for the modern pick and mix, Gurdjieff, meditation, and mindfulness. In a previous era, his interests would mark him out as a lively man keeping up with trends. If one was being unkind, one would have said he was having a midlife crisis. Today, a new narrative of choice and constant updating provides the context for his activities. There is a sense that change, personal enhancement, and being on trend is especially valuable. Transformation, upgrading, revamping have become the valued categories of late. But for whom? What does a diet of constant change offer the individual and the collective? What's driving the imperative? Who does it serve? How does it affect us individually and socially? And what are the downsides? I recently visited Beijing and Shanghai, courtesy of the British Council. They say if you leave town for a month, you no longer recognize your neighborhood. Building is everywhere. Our 32nd floor luxury hotel room in Beijing overlooked a 16-lane highway with a 10-lane underneath it. When we asked if we could have a different view, the hotel staff were perplexed. What was wrong? It was a fine view. Hypermodernity is relished. Displaced people replaced by Porsches, Toyotas, Hermes, Estee Lauder and Gucci in mall upon mall upon mall, albeit that no one I met could afford what was in the mall. New buildings and superfast subways emblazon the change, reinforcing the notion and the reality of a society on speed. We're encouraged to embrace the pace of change that mimics the behaviors of orders put into the Chinese factories. New clothes, not every season, but every few weeks, even if there's no money for it. To accommodate this, we can now all have multiple personalities. Like the pop videos that have their stars performing as sex kittens, bosses, mummers, chatelaines, motorbike enthusiasts, acrobats, all in the space of 2.47 minutes, we too can consume the vast range of goods by donning hunting garb on a Saturday morning, albeit we don't hunt, and then a demure afternoon tea outfit later that day. As 6 o'clock approaches, a cocktail dress will suit, and later at night there'll be sexually teasing lingerie for the bedroom. Changing outfits has been democratized and extended well outside the haute bourgeoisie and celebrity culture. It nourishes the engine of late capitalism. As we spin in constant motion, fitting ourselves to the exigency of the latest must-have, we feed the beast that is the market. Those on lower incomes do not escape these imperatives. Indeed, they're encouraged to buy into the idea, as are the upper and middle classes, that belonging, being a someone, means wearing the clothes, having the car, showing one's stuff. Class is allegedly replaced by aspiration. If you can look the part, you can be the part. The realities of massive social inequality, the greatest we've seen in post-war Britain, is effaced by the carapace to individually self-invent. Change is the cruel poultice offered to soothe the horrors of injustice. The notion of self-invention is worth mentioning here too. It's an appealing idea. Wherever we come from, whatever we've done, whatever mistakes we've made, whatever direction we've gone in so far, we can rethink, we can reevaluate, and we can change. We can become the person we want to be. So far, so good. Who could fault such desire or the endeavor it implies? Why would one criticize the sentiment? Self-invention sounds purposeful and serious. Thinking, evaluating, developing self-knowledge is an essential food for the human spirit. But let's slow down a bit. If we fold in the other ideas that go with it, it's as though one can discard one's past like an unwanted dress or suit. And we can't. People aren't fashion. They have history. They come from somewhere. They have attachments. The most abused, the most ignored, the most hurt, all those who might wish to flee and reinvent themselves, know they can only move forward with the acknowledgement of their past and what they've come from. Otherwise, self-invention means dislocation from history and a deep dislocation from oneself. In striving to be the person you want to be, there may be enormous losses, fracturing and alienation. Of late, I've seen a rather disturbing number of young people who've been on the self-invention path. And inevitably, since I'm a shrink, I see the ones for whom this hasn't worked out so well. Who am I, they say? What do people see? Why am I not feeling good, given the things that I've achieved? Things don't work because the propulsion to self-invent and change has been driven by the renunciation of unmet emotional needs. Reinvention tries to say, I don't need what I didn't get. I'll get it elsewhere. I'll get it for myself. I'll be my own creation and my own object of admiration. But the sad fact is, we do need to understand the impact of not getting what we needed. What's the problem for which reinvention is the answer? If we can't address that question, then consuming markers of status, inventing new lifestyles, will be an endless treadmill benefiting few, least of all those on a quest to feel safe and to find a place of belonging and of mattering. As we know, solutions to things going wrong can start very early. A recent UNICEF report examining why children in the UK were ranked lowest of the developed nations for well-being found that it came from the relentless consumerism offered to time-poor families. Parents are under pressure, and consumerism has stepped into the space. Parents have often been under pressure. That's not new. There wasn't a bucolically perfect parent, perfect child time when everything was wonderful. Children were often left free to roam or amuse themselves, and out of boredom, some devised interesting activities to please themselves with. But rarely so now. Relentless consumerism is a demand to change by replacing or adding to our possessions all the time. What kind of horror are we visiting on our children by implying that having things, more things, new things, is the prescription for life? Consumerism is the ugly sister of change. Its pleas for the latest toy and gadgets ring out from every household. Choice and change have become onerous rather than fun. Change purely for profit means that the cultural moment lasts a few months instead of a few years. The designs and aspirations mutate rapidly. It will be hard for people to look back on these times and see the aesthetic imprint of a decade in the way that we can readily identify the 1920s, the 30s, the 40s, all the way up through to the 80s, actually. Perhaps that doesn't matter, but I'm not so sure. We don't live for the historical record, but neither are we ahistorical beings. The idea that we'll pass on something, make the world a better place, leave something to be remembered, has been our custom and our cultural contract. But how realistic is that contract today? Perhaps our artists will do that for us. I hope so. The voraciousness of change is affecting us badly, socially, environmentally, and individually. Therapy is often characterized as a change technology. Some might argue that the whole point of therapy is to change. Certainly, therapies are sold that way, and no one enters therapy looking to stay the same. Indeed, I'm not arguing against change itself in this lecture. That would be ludicrous. Change is part of the human condition. It's what makes us and defines us as humans. We develop, we do things differently. We aren't moles building the same kind of hill over and over and over again. Human consciousness and existence is predicated on the capacity to change and develop. There are few things more delightful than watching babies take their first steps or discovering one can actually communicate in a foreign tongue after the huge efforts of learning the grammar and vocabulary and stumbling inarticulately for ages. So it's not change itself that I'm contesting, but the commercial harnessing of the idea of change, which brings in so much destructiveness. Therapy of the psychoanalytic kind, that's my job, is more concerned with exploring the problems and impediments to change as one's in the process of change. People come to therapy not to change, but because by and large they're in difficulty with themselves. Something, some things, or indeed many things about their experience are not working. They've exhausted their personal emotional resources. They're frustrated. A crisis, often precipitated by loss, propels them to seek the reflective space that therapy offers. As they try to find the words and the feelings for what so hurts, the experience mutates. It doesn't disappear, but it sits inside them differently. The experience isn't split off, disowned, or repressed in a manner that is undermining. It becomes instead known and thus integrated. That ownership is transformative. It constitutes change. Not the kind of change that's about the dismissal or rejection of self, but a change that occurs as a result of acceptance. Therapy is a challenge to the notion of the rational. Or perhaps I should say, it limits what we might understand as rational and how far we can go with rationality as a concept. We live with the ideas of the subjective and objective realms, often disparaging the former and elevating the latter as though they were into two entirely different modes of thinking, being, and feeling. In truth, this division is unsustainable. Subjective and objective thoughts and feelings are the outcome of different knowledges that are related. The subjective, which is often seen as personal, idiosyncratic, and intuitive, sits on and is entwined with structures of thinking which are designated as logical, deductive, and analytic. If we pause and consider how we use this unreflected division, it becomes apparent that the way an individual, be they a barrister, a cook, a parent, a dancer, makes a logical, analytic argument is always with reference to their own lived experience. The rational, sealed off from experience has no salience. It can wreak havoc. Let's not forget an important part of the current economic meltdown, the reliance on the mathematical physicists known as the quants, who in their first large-scale outing at the Long-Term Capital Management Fund lost nearly $2 billion while owing over $100 billion in the space of just 3 weeks back in September 1998. That was rationalism at its maddest and most manic. And so too is the notion that the subjective is a deeper, more authentic truth, spurious. The subjective is always structured by the cultural rules and